Dave Montgomery, who's a fluvial geomorphologist from the University of Washington, says that the amount of erosion in agriculture, including organic agriculture lands, can be as high as the erosion in alpine environments. And that means it's releasing massive amounts of material into the air.
But we can, the thing is, we can actually farm in such a way that we would reverse this.
That's right.
We could totally reverse this. So what is it? What are these microorganisms doing with the plants? I mean, what are they, what's happening there? I mean, there was something about root exudates and carbon, and what is that?
Well, when plants take, you know, plants are the original solar collectors. You know, they take carbon out of the air. They take carbon dioxide out of the air, and they turn it into their own fuel. They turn it into a carbon-based fuel for themselves to build, you know, their stems and their, you know, fruits and all of that. But 40% of that carbon fuel that they create, they send down to their roots. And down at their roots, these soil microorganisms come and feed. They take the carbon sugars, and in exchange for those sugars, they leave behind a bounty of mineral nutrients that they've that the microorganisms have released from rocks. And then after they eat that carbon sugar, then they go on, they eat each other, they excrete in the soil, they build little structures in the soil using carbon glue. So all of that activity, you know, they're just carrying on their own business, but their own business, when they carry on their own business the way they're supposed to and the way they have for millions and millions and millions of years, what that does is store, you know, put that carbon safely in the ground where it belongs, where it's a, you know, an amazing life-giving element instead of something that is overwhelming our atmosphere.
Yeah, most plants can grow in soluble forms of nutrients, but they can't access insoluble forms. That's why you can grow a plant in sterile environments in the middle of the Midwest or in a hydroponic system. But they can't access the most of the nutrients that are locked into rock materials. And who can are the fungi and bacteria. And they have the ability to unlock nitrates and ammonium and hold it in their bodies until protozoa and nematodes come and eat them and release them to the plants.
So it's a cycle that just keeps going on. And one of the things I read is that in a teaspoon of soil, 1 to 7 billion little life forms in just one teaspoon of soil?
Easily.
Yeah.
I wish your listeners could look into a microscope that, you know, that we have and see all the tiny little organisms that are pocketed around in every little crevice of soil organic matter.
But the farming practices that farmers have been using break up all that life stuff. I mean, somehow, like even the tilling that was going on 10,000 years ago, it's been exacerbated now with pesticides and fertilizers.
Well, here's a good example to you: the Dust Bowl, which was triggered by, you know, the need for wheat production in the World Wars. Released with the loss of feet of topsoil, released more CO2 into the atmosphere than the entire history of motor vehicle use on this planet.
Wow.
And so we're destroying the buffering capacity of the planet. So building soil can bring a lot of that back in.
So that's what we've got to start doing. And the plants and the microorganisms basically have been doing this, you said, for millions and millions of years.
Right. This is a process that's been going on for millions and millions of years. When plants, you know, moved to land, there was already this very thriving community of microorganisms in the soil. And plants sort of tapped into that. You know, they tapped into this kind of nutrient and water distribution system that was already going on in the soil. So, you know, one of the ways that we interfere with that in our agriculture is by plowing. And, of course, that's been going on for thousands of years. But in modern agriculture, in modern conventional agriculture, we really interfere with that partnership but with fertilizers. You know, when we dump fertilizers into the soil, I mean, one of the scientists that I spoke to said plants get lazy. You know, when we're dumping these high potency fertilizers right by the plant's roots, they don't need to conduct that trading with the soil microorganisms. So as a result, the plants are getting an overdose of nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. But the soil microorganisms are sort of, you know, turning themselves down.
They're not getting their carbon sugars.
Sometimes they're not getting their carbon sugars. They will, you know, they will become sort of quiet. They can even start to die off. That means that the plants, I mean, so not only are we breaking up that partnership and making the soil less healthy, because it's the microorganisms that are making the soil healthy, but what we're doing is creating food that does not have the full supply of nutrients that we need, that all life needs.
Right. The microorganisms, I talked about them being a little packet of holding on to those nutrients.
Right.
The soluble forms of nutrients that we add for chemical fertilizer, and also some of the issues that we put in with organic fertilizers, they have this soluble nutrients, and if the plants don't take it up, and they usually don't take all of it up, and there aren't the organisms to hold on to it, it gets into our water supply and it gets into the groundwater, ultimately leading to eutrophication and anaerobic conditions in the oceans.
Yeah, big giant dead zones and things like that.
And every time this happens, which happens every few million years, every couple score million years, we have a mass extinction on the planet because of hydrogen sulfide gas, which is the smell of rotten eggs.
Oh boy.
Coming up into the air. So we have a responsibility to be holding this soil, and not just holding it like a lot of soil conservation systems have out there, but actually coming up with ways of inoculating the subsoil to improve and expand this process.
Right.
We need to get those organisms deeper into the soil.
And that was another thing about the depth. I mean, like, I think, was it Gabe Brown or one of these people could stick a stick in the ground and...
No, it wasn't a stick. That was my rock star farmer in this book. When I met him and I was touring his farm, because there was a guy with the National Wildlife Federation who was doing a report on future-friendly farming. So he was going around looking at all the different kinds of farming that were going on in the country and what was the best for the environment. So that was how I got to Gabe Brown's farm in North Dakota. And so he was taking me around, and he had this 4-foot-long moisture probe that he was sort of using to poke at different plants and point out different things. But we walked into one of his cornfields, and he bent over and shoved this moisture probe, which is a 4-foot rod, with a blunt end.
4 feet. Blunt
shoved
end.
Shoved it down into the soil as if he was, you know, pushing it into a huge can of coffee grinds. And I thought, oh, he's a big, strong guy. He can do that. I probably can't. I could do it, too. Mm-hmm. And then we walked off his farm into some of the neighboring farms and tried it there, where they were also good farmers, but they weren't doing the full suite of soil building things that he was doing. But it is amazing the kind of changes that can happen with the soil.
So this partnership needs a couple things. It needs air access, it needs water, but not so much water that it pushes out the air permanently.
Right.
And it needs, you know, the primary nutrients and the ability to have all those things. So one thing to think about is plant roots can go very deep and bring this ecosystem with them. You can go to caves in southern Oregon and see the roots of the conifer trees sticking out 100 feet under the ground in the soil. The real issue is when you have compaction, even subtle compaction, like what we create when we step in the garden, that holds water in place and starts to create alcohols and anaerobic decomposition, and plants can't move through alcohol layers. They can move through solid rock if there's room for them to crack in, but they can't move through even a simple little layer of alcohol.
So it's really about... And big tractors are really doing that. They're like smooshing the ground down as they roll around on it and stuff.
They're basically doing container gardening.
Container gardening.
On the earth, you know.
Yeah, and this idea that you could go so deep. I mean, that the softness of the soil, and that it would protect against drought because there's water being able to sink down really, really deep into the soil.
So his infiltration rate, he started working on his land... I think it's been about 14 years. But, of course, it was an accumulation. You know, at the beginning, he was just trying to survive. Mm-hmm. I'd say probably in the last 8 years, he's really been focusing on soil health. But his infiltration rate, meaning the amount of time that it takes water to percolate down into his soil, it went from 0.5 inch in an hour to 8 inches in an hour.
Wow.
But that's just really remarkable when you think about the kind of resilience that builds in an environment to drought.
And floods.
To flood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all those things. To wildfire.
Yeah, yeah. Rivers get regulated and stop being quite as incising and eroding.
It just makes so much sense.
But
anyway.
Something I would like to point out is that every soil is trying to heal itself ultimately. And you know, you might go into your yard and hear about the soil we just described and say, oh, my soil isn't there. How do I get there?
Uh-huh.
But what's happening is you look and you see those dandelions. And the reason that they're there, because if you think about it, in soil, there's so many seeds that don't germinate. They just aren't in the right moment to germinate. And if that soil is super compact it means that there isn't very much calcium in that soil, and the clay's formed into a hard pan. You know who can bring calcium and who can dig deep into that is dandelions. So the plant's structure tells you a lot about what's happening in soil conditions. If your soil's loose and not very structured and doesn't have a lot of life, you might have plants that go in with really hair roots and just kind of like hold the soil in place until it can stabilize for other plants. So your weed communities that are
telling
in
you
poor,
a lot.
Quote unquote, poor soil, they're telling you a lot about what actually the direction you can amplify that system in order to get it working the way we're talking about.
I sort of look at the dandelions that are in my yard now as like little friends, you know, do your work.
Exactly. This is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm speaking with Jordan Fink, a permaculture teacher, and Kristen Olson, author of The Soil Will Save Us: How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. Kristen will also be at Powell's on Burnside tomorrow at 7:30. And for people who are interested, there's a permaculture course being offered this weekend at Kailash Eco Village. That's K-A-I-L-A-S-H. Jordan will be there. And
it's actually a permaculture convergence. And anybody can come. If you go on their website, there's actually like, I mean, there's a small fee. I don't know how much it is, but it's
Show
very
up.
Much worth coming. You'll learn a ton and you'll make some good friends and we'll garden together.
Kailash Eco Village. Check it out. And K-A-I-L-A-S-H. And let's see. And also, if people want to call in here, the phone number is 503-231-8187. Okay, thank you. 503-231-8187. Anyway, call in with your questions. But I want to get back to that. So there are ways that we can farm to save our soil or to start really putting this whole thing that we've done back into reverse. And one of them that Gabe Brown, again, your rock star, messy gardens. Jordan, you were saying earlier that maybe it doesn't have to be so messy, but in other words, it's not to be afraid of having a messy garden. And what was that about?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things about that is you don't need to be so eager to scrape away every single leaf that falls in your garden. And I'm talking about my garden at home. I try not to scrape away those leaves. I try to leave them there so that they can add their nutrients to the soil and have something for the microorganisms to chew on if there's nothing growing there. Same thing with weeds. I figure until I've got enough of the plants that I want growing there to take over the surface of the ground, you know, I'm okay with the weeds being there.
Uh-huh. And that, do you see that too? Or you had a slightly less messy version?
Well, what I think is in some ways that
he's a pro.
we have a little bit of a misunderstanding in our culture about what constitutes order and what constitutes messiness. And we order our systems based on what our goals are. And when your goal is rapid harvest and maximizing one kind of production at the cost of long-term sustainability, then nice rows, irregardless of the shape of the land, I guess they're the best thing you have because you already have water coming in pipes and you already have your nutrients coming in spray. And so you're just about getting out there as quick as possible. But if you're actually interested in improving ecosystems, you have to understand how ecosystems are structured. And there is a method to the madness in the chaos of ecosystems. And some of that has to do with understanding where do we want the water to go? Where do we want the plants to be able to interact with each other? What are the patterns that happen in nature that allow one type of species to have a balanced relationship with another species?
Right.
So that does not look like rows. It looks like often scatterings. It looks like wildflowers in a meadow. But there is order to that madness.
And we have a caller. What's his name? Joanne, would you like to make your question or comment?
Yes, I'd like to know if there's radiation in the soil from nuclear plants, whatever, does anyone know anywhere whether the soil can heal from that? Anyway, I'll get off and listen.
Okay.
Well,
idea?
I mean, there's always problems with nuclear radiation. So I can say three things about that. One is that we can use specialist organisms like fungi that are designed to accumulate heavy metals to get those out of the soil and somewhere we can contain them.
Mm-hmm.
That's one level, just getting it out of the soil as best as possible. The other is that good humic acid, all these organic molecules that are complex and hold onto these nutrients, they have the ability to tie up a lot of heavy metals and other minerals and stop them from being sequestered from plants. So that's another benefit, that we can stop the uptake into food systems from poisoned soil. And the third I want to add is that there is a flower, and I think it's the Idaho snake root. This is not correct, but it's called something like that, and I'll have to let you know. But it is used in Japan around nuclear power plants, because if you look at it under a microscope, you can see radiation levels in the color of the cells on the anthers.
Wow.
So you can plant plants that are radiation indicators.
Wow.
And I'll have to remember what plant that is.
Yeah, because as we get our Fukushima rain, we'll have to be paying attention to that kind of thing more and more.
That's my answer to that is that, you know, it's a huge issue. We shouldn't be messing around with radioactive material anyway.
Exactly.
But now that we live in a world that does, I've heard of people mushroom harvesting in Russia and setting off Geiger counters at airports, not realizing that they were in the
Chernobyl area.
The Chernobyl area.
Wow.
Their mushrooms were radioactive enough to set off Geiger counters.
Scary. Anyway, another part about the Gabe Brown rock star status thing here is he was really into, as part of his messiness, what he called cover crop cocktails. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about that a little?
Right. Well, he started off as a conventional farmer, and then found that he was failing because he hit 4 years of, you know, terrible drought, early frost, you know, all these things, or late frost, that he kept losing his crops. And so he started to try to let nature do the kinds of things. He couldn't afford chemicals anymore, so he decided to have nature do the things for his crops that that the chemical manufacturers were telling him to do. But one of the things that he discovered was that his fields that had simple cover crops were healthier than and lasting through drought longer than other fields. And then he heard about this a scientist down in Brazil who was proposing cover crop. So the whole thing with cover crops are crops that you don't take to market. Cover crops are something that people have used for hundreds, if not thousands, of years to protect the soil from erosion. They're not used widely enough in our country, and it's a very small number of farmers that do it. But what cover crops do, and the reason for the cocktail, so he will now have fields that have up to 30 species planted in it, from little tiny radishes to great big sunflowers. And he is trying to replicate the kind of structures that you would see in a dense forest, you know, from the tiniest plants to the tallest plants. And what's happening underground when that happens, it's the same kind of relationship underground in terms of root structure. You know, you have shallow roots and you have very, very deep roots. And what he's doing with that is, well, he also calls it biological tilling, because some of those really deep-rooted plants are getting, working way down into the soil. Breaking it up way down there.
So he can stick a stick down.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's how he gets soil like that. But so, you know, I think the idea that he's always trying to achieve on his property, and that I'm trying to achieve even in my own little yard in Cleveland, is dense, you know, that there's a lot of vegetation on the ground, no bare soil, diverse. The more diverse, nature is diverse. You know, if you look at native prairie, you know, there's hundreds of species represented in a foot. If you look at modern conventional agriculture, you see one species in a foot. So he's, with that cover crop cocktail, he's got all those different species, and they are sending down carbon sugars, different recipes of those carbon sugars to feed those soil microorganisms that are down below. So that diverse crop above ground is feeding a really diverse and healthy herd. He calls them his other herd. You know, he's got his herd of cattle. He's got his herd of microorganisms underground. So that diverse crop, cover crop, is feeding that diverse herd underground. And then, after his cover crop, so this is what he does to, you know, remediate a piece of, you know, land that's been ruined by conventional agriculture. He'll do these cover crop fields for a couple of seasons. He has his cows come in and eat them after they're finished growing. So you have the further improvement of the ground from that animal impact. By the time he gets around to planting a crop that he wants to sell to market, his soil is amazing, and he makes a lot of money.
And we have a caller again. Who's Mike? What was your question? You still there?
Hello. Oh, am I up?
Yeah, you're up.
Hey, I'm a longtime horticulturist, gardener. My big concern locally and for most people that live in Portland and like to have a garden and are at the whim, if I can use that term, of the Portland Water Bureau, I know that the subject has been pretty much eliminated for the time being, but watering our gardens with water that has fluoride in it. I brought this issue up to Steve Novick when he was running for office, although he's not in charge of the Water Bureau. Is kind of
okay. Well, so we can ask the question then. What if anybody have any notions about fluoride in the water when we water?
Yeah.
Well, actually, I'm not very aware of the impacts of fluoride. I tend to err on the side of not wanting to put medicine in our water. But one thing that I'm concerned about that is in our water is chloramines, which are very useful for making drinking water safe if it's been contaminated. But the real problem with it is that they persist. And they can kill off soil organisms. Yep. But luckily, they can be rendered, they can break apart if they have contact with humic acid. So what I always recommend for people starting seed or concerned about chloramines is putting a lump of humic acid dirt in your water for about a half hour, mixing it up before you start your seeds.
Just old dirt.
Yeah. I mean, humic acid is incredible in its capacity to break apart complex molecules.
Humic acid.
Chloramine, is it a salt?
No, it's
chloramine is chlorine, I think.
Basically. I don't think it's a salt form, but I could be wrong. It's been a while since I've looked at chlorine chemistry.
Okay.
Well, okay, I'd want to get. Thank you so much, though, Mike.
I'm sorry.
I just want to say thank you a lot. We're going to probably get back to things again.
Well, fluorine is a salt, and it's persistent in the soil. That's the big concern for me. Thank you very much.
Okay, that's great, Mike. And I think that could be something that we research here.
Yeah, and thank you for raising that. I will do some research and investigate more about the role of fluoride in carbon farming.
That's good work, folks.
Thank you.
And back to, real quick again, the microorganisms are doing all this work in the soil, and then also the cows. That's another part of this whole thing. And there was a way that he does the cows, though. It's not just a bunch of cows out in a field. They're in little padlocks. They're really tight, and they have to keep moving. And that was a big, sort of like Joel Salatin did with Omnivore's Dilemma.
Right. And all these, it's called, well, in the case of Gabe Brown, he would probably call it holistic grazing. And it's based on the teachings of Alan Savory, who's a biologist from Africa, who's been talking about this for years and years. And, you know, Alan Savory's, he was a game warden, a game manager. He observed desertification in Africa and tried to figure out, everybody was saying that it was cattle that were doing it, but he noticed that areas would continue to degrade even if the cattle weren't there. So he really made a study of how grasslands, you know, these lush grasslands develop. They develop because they co-evolved with grazing herds. And so he came up with a way of managing animals on the land, cattle, so that they replicate the behavior of ancient herds. And ancient herds do not behave the way, so if we're out driving around in the country and we drive past a place that has cattle, you know, usually they're in one large field that has a fence around it, and they're turned out there all year, and they just wander around and eat what they want. That's not how ancient herds behaved. What those cattle do who are fenced in when we domesticated them is that they will eat what they prefer, and they will eat that down to the ground and kill it. So that's what actually contribute. That's how cattle can contribute to poor soil health.
Yeah.
But what Alan Savory realized was that the ancient herds travel closely together. They don't wander out. They stay in a pack because they were afraid of predators. They keep moving over the ground because they don't want to eat their, you know, brothers and sisters dung and urine. So they keep moving, and so they eat down the grass, and actually they're biting at the grass causes it to work harder to capture carbon and build carbon sugars, and it's actually a beneficial effect on the grass. So he developed this method called holistic grazing. So that's what Gabe Brown does, and many other ranchers are now doing. They move they move the cattle so that they eat the grass, but they don't kill it. They keep moving them.
Uh-huh. Right.
So one thing I wanted to add to that is that there's I love bison, but there's a little bit of a myth that bison and cows have huge differences in their behavior. If you just have a few bison on your property and treat them the same way you treat a cows, they'll have the same negative impact.
Uh-huh.
The issue is, are they clumped? And cows like being clumped, just like bison do. They like being in herds, uh-huh, next to each other with their young inside the herd to be protected.
Right.
But they don't do that if they feel mellow, if they feel like, you know, and also if they're kept in a place long enough, there's uneven grass growth. And so they're looking for the sweet grass and they're ignoring the old grass. And the real problem with that is that grass isn't like an oak tree. It doesn't drop its leaves. It holds their leaves up until somebody comes and eats them. And in dry lands, it can actually choke itself out. So that's why the giant bison herds that used to go across this country, swooping across the land, you know, mowing it down and then leaving as soon as they'd eaten everything, that grass had time to then push more of those exudates into the soil, drop huge amounts of carbon from the atmosphere, and then grow back in time for the next herds to come through.
God, and then we just ended up slaughtering them with our railroad trains. It's things are so insane, and I want to kind of get to that a little bit. Real quick here, though, we do have a caller, and I just want to say again that this is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm speaking with Jordan Fink, who's a permaculture teacher, and Kristen Olson, who's author of The Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. Kristen's going to be at Powell's tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m. on West Burnside, and Jordan will be at Kailash Eco Village. They're doing a permaculture convergence there this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Check out their website, Kailash Eco Village. And who's our caller is Bob? Hello, Bobby.
My Native American ancestors, the Sioux, you know, needed the bison, the buffalo, to survive. And it wasn't just the meat, it was the beautiful pelts that kept you warm in the winter in North Dakota.
Yeah. So what was your question then, Bob?
The question is about, for a senior such as I and my wife, of our age on my little lot here, 100 by 100, what can we grow? And I don't really expect you to go through a scenario of what is the best crop. I mean, I'm trying to do things in case of a shortage of food next year. Go ahead.
Okay, what do we grow?
Well, first of all, I want to know, because this is a show that's on the internet, where are you in the country, Bob?
I'm in North Portland. Where are you?
Oh, perfect. I'm in Southeast Portland right now.
Oh, cool.
Well, yeah,
anyway, we have a lot in the house, and a little house on a giant lot.
Well, first off,
you go ahead.
Well,
tell
Bob,
me what would be good here. I have pears now and so forth.
Well, Bob, first of all, I'm curious what it is that you want to grow there. What are your goals? Is it food or is it just carbon?
Well, food, yeah, not buffalo, food and vegetables. Okay, a lot of vegetables.
Well, how's your soil right now? How does it look?
It looks pretty good. We have very good soil. It was done before.
And what weeds do you currently have?
Was the carrots? Kale, is that, can you name a few? I'm up in age, I'm 80, so you give me
Is your kale doing well?
Yeah, it seemed to be last year.
Okay, a lot of people in Portland right now, the soils, I've been testing them and looking under the microscope, they're really suited for kale, which means that they don't have quite enough fungi to grow other vegetables as well. So I'd be recommending things that actually improve the ongoing health of your soil. So what I would do is I would keep growing kale, but I would also start putting down mulches. I would start putting down straw, but you know, there's always the concern about slugs, so you have to be making sure you're not compacting your soil at the same time. But I would start putting in things that loosen up your soil. There's nothing wrong with throwing a little bit of daikon radish around your garden and not necessarily harvesting it, because that daikon will dig deep and leave little compost pockets in your soil. And I'll start moving things along a little bit.
Do we have to turn over more than 3 inches of the topsoil?
I would actually recommend not doing that. I'd recommend no-till. And that doesn't always work the first year, but it can. And so what you do is you put down some sort of barrier. I always put down wet cardboard. And then on top of that, some compost. And on top of that, something carbony like wood chips that are hardwood, not conifer, or straw. And you can plant right in that compost layer. And that will do the same thing that a natural ecosystem will do. You know, every year a forest drops its sticks and leaves right on top of the soil. And, you know, we can drop a forest onto our soil really fast.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I really want to thank you for that. Oh, one comment about the earlier call.
Yeah.
We had an election here about no fluoride. And if anybody goes back to their lack of education, now I'm come from the poverty too, but I studied hard to learn how to do things. And I think our young people need to be more articulate and knowledgeable, and especially with a big election like that on fluoride. He didn't even know we don't have fluoride in our water.
Yeah, we don't.
Don't have it, and Nesbitt is trying to do that, and they're spending millions to do it, and they get the water free. Oh. They just pump it up, put it in these plastic bottles that they get from David and Charles Koch. By the way, they're five Koch brothers.
Okay, thanks, Bob. We're going to kind of move along here, but really appreciate your comments.
I'm sorry, I do a monologue.
I know, I can tell.
No, it's fine, Bob. You're great.
Well, I'm knowledgeable.
You know what? You got to have a radio show here on KBOO, Bob. Anyway, so
20 presidents since I've been alive,
and that's,
I had been one of them this foot and a half. But go ahead, ma'am.
Okay. Anyway, I want to kind of get to public policy here before we really run out of time.
Yeah, let's do it.
And that's part of it is like, you know, how are we voting? And we there. You, Kristen, you had a chapter in your book called "Why Don't We Know This Stuff?"
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about
and,
that.
And we don't know this stuff because, like, people. In fact, you were saying that one of the reasons you wrote this book is because people really don't know that there's this life under our soil that could change everything. And our public policies are killing our soil. They're destroying it more, aren't they?
Well, I think that one of the things that we don't know. I think that we're often posed with a false dichotomy that we can either have enough food or we can have good food, and you know, take your pick. And I think that that is a position that's very it scares people. You know,
right.
when you hear about how the world population is growing, you know, you don't want people to starve, so it sort of scares you into thinking, oh gosh, I guess there's nothing that we can do that's better than the system we have. You know, it might not make good food, but it makes a lot of food. And the fact is that studies have shown that we can do both. We can make good food and we can make a lot of food. And we just have to realize that we do have that choice.
And well, like, exactly, because it seemed like some of these farmers were actually leasing less land because they were growing so much more food. And I was just amazed at that. But we got into this whole thing back in the 70s with Earl Butz, and where we just really started pushing big ag programs. And
the Nixon ag bills did not do well for ag policy around soil development.
Right.
They really maximized extraction rather than maximizing soil care.
Right. And that we've just been sort of proceeding down that line ever since, it sounds like.
I would like to add, though, that it's funny, like a lot of the knowledge that we're using to be able to do soil sequestration and building, it actually doesn't, it's not new knowledge. A lot of it comes from Charles Darwin. His last book was On the Formation of Vegetable Mold Through the Action of Worms.
Beautiful.
And he thought it was the most important work he had done in his life, more important than The Origin of Species, because he was able to show that the movement of worms and the movement of the soil through the worms was a geologic process greater than almost any other process that he was looking at for renewals of fertility. And he felt like that was the most important thing he had done. And so we've been knowing this about worms, about landscapes for a long time. A lot of the techniques we use were developed in the 50s by geologists who started thinking about the way that land and its shape and the design of buildings, roads, and other structures could contribute or, you know, add to the problem of soil development.
Right. And part of this is, well, actually, we do have another caller. What was his name? Ron. Okay, Ron, what would you like to ask?
Yes, I'd like to ask about, he was talking about laying down cardboard, and I'm out here in a space in Vancouver, and the guy that owns the place believes in laying down cardboard to prevent weeds. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I moved the cardboard, and there's a lot of moles around here, and I'm sure there's a bunch of mice, but I moved cardboard one day, and man, I saw all the little varmints start, you know, scampering. So tell me, what do you do to get rid of all the little rodents that you're going to create?
Okay.
Or that are already there, even?
Well, I want to make sure one thing. Are you sure that it's moles or is it gophers? Do you know?
No, I can't be sure. I haven't Gophers are pretty big, so I would say these are moles.
Well, the difference between gophers and moles in terms of their diet is that gophers are the ones that are eating your plant roots, and moles are mostly eating insects. They're insectivores. And so, you know, you may not like the aesthetic of them, but they are serving an ecological function, which is that they're digging holes and furrows in the ground and loosening the soil. They're part of the soil ecosystem. So it depends on if, you know, you have a personal preference for removing them, then that's a separate issue. But I would actually recommend that if you can get a positive identification that they are moles, then I wouldn't worry as much, because they do not eat healthy plant roots.
Good.
Okay. But they're not good for foundations, though, are they?
I don't think that they mess around with foundations much. They're mostly just looking for critters.
Okay.
Okay,
but you know, there's always the possibility that there's more to that, and I'm willing to do some more research and report back here if I discover that there are an issue for foundations.
Yeah, it's a great idea, because there is a little foundation problem here too.
So. Mm-hmm. I want to take care of everything.
Yeah, sheet mulching, like I recommended to Bob back there, is not good if you have bindweed, because bindweed loves crawling under that sheet mulch, and it also will temporarily attract more slugs until you get a deep soil.
Bindweed, like blackberries?
No, bindweed is a
bindweed.
It's a form of morning glory that often takes over.
Okay, we have another caller, by the way.
Thank you.
Lee, what would you like to ask?
Well, I had heard about this issue of soil organic carbon several years ago. And the thing that really struck made my ears perk up was the fact that if we increase the soil organic carbon content by 1%, it will hold 60,000 gallons of water per acre.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier. It's mm-hmm. It's profound.
And in terms of, you know, what we've done in terms of channelizing streams mm-hmm. and, you know, disrupting, you know, the natural flow patterns.
Absolutely.
If we want to prevent more flooding, we need to increase the soil organic carbon.
Right. It can have a really profound effect on watersheds.
Thank mm-hmm. you.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to add another fact to that, I did a little bit of back of the envelope calculations about a year ago, so I need to always fact check. But what I figured out was that if you took current landscapes on the planet that are used for agriculture or grazing, and you took the top foot of the soil and raised its organic matter content 9.6%, you'd pull 100 parts per million of CO2 out of the Earth's atmosphere, which is 1770s levels.
We got to do this. Back to some just really things about the policy again, though. Like one of the things you were saying, we've known this a long time, but researchers in universities are being paid by Big Ag usually and things like that. So some of the stuff that we do know is being suppressed, and you were talking about that in your book a little bit.
Government funding for the land grant universities, which is supposed to be, you know, those are supposed to be carrying on research about agriculture for the good of our nation. Government funding to those institutions has been declining since the mm-hmm. 1970s, and I think in 1993, I can't, right around there, the amount of money that has filled that gap from private industry. So now private industry is funding more research at our land-grant universities than the government is. And, you know, and what happens with that is that they're the ones who are the nature of the research follows the money. The money doesn't follow the research, you
right.
know.
Yeah.
So they are dictating the direction of the research that's going on at our land-grant universities. And that, you know, and of course, they're interested in
selling fertilizer.
They're interested in selling fertilizer and trying out the mm-hmm. next pesticide and trying this herbicide. They are mm-hmm. not interested in natural systems. And even in public universities where there are some researchers who manage to get the funding to do this good research on natural systems, you know, and restoring landscapes, the university's press offices are not disseminating that information.
And this information is also just repressed through, you know, not having ecological literacy taught in schools and
right.
other places. Like, you can go and look at USDA records of soil, and you can find that the numbers show that there's enough insoluble forms of nutrients to feed us forever. There's really no lack of nutrients. The issue is that everybody focuses on solubles, which if you don't have enough solubles, where are you going to get your solubles? If you don't have microorganisms, you need to get them from a can, right?
It's crazy. Again, we're already zooming through this show here. It's the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm speaking with Jordan Fink, a permaculture teacher who will be at Kailash Eco Village this weekend and doing a permaculture convergence. And Kristen Olson, who's the author of Soil Will Save Us, How Scientists, Farmers, and Foodies Are Healing the Soil to Save the Planet. Mm-hmm. And Kristen will be at Powell's on Burnside tomorrow night at 7:30. And I hope you can make it to see her. This is great stuff.
And so one thing I wanted to add about government policy is that, you know, there was a thread of research within the USDA on sustainable practices and soil improving. And it was called ATRA, which was completely defunded during the Bush administration, and there's been no effort on the Obama administration to refund it, which I think is the appropriate technology transfer for something. I don't remember exactly what ATRA is, but ATRA is where a huge amount of that research and funds were, and we don't have it anymore. It's gone the way of the National Endowment for the Arts.
So it's like
and
farmers things. Like Gabe Brown doing it on their own more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, no. See, that's there are some positive developments. And I think even in the last farm bill, you know, crummy as the farm bills are, I think that there was more money in there to do, so one of the scientists and really fine public servants that I spoke to for this book is a scientist with the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, and he is working on a program with some Oregon wheat farmers on helping them transition from farming in which they plow to no-till farming.
Great.
And so he's using government money to help them through that 3-year transition period, and also helping them access carbon credits. So they'll be paid for the carbon that they're conserving in the soil, and they'll be paid for the carbon that they're going to build in the soil. So there are some good partnerships that are happening. It's not enough, but there are some good directions.
I agree that the NRCS is definitely a place that tries to bridge between property owners and streams and ecosystems. And I think the NRCS has actually done a lot more for soil than strict agriculture parts of the...
As they should.
Mm-hmm. And this is the sort of thing I want to get into, like what we need to be promoting here, the last little bit we have. But we have two callers. So, Kristen, what would you like to ask? Kristen to Kristen.
Oh, thank you. Thank you all for supporting KBOO and this good work you're doing. So in my backyard, I would love to be growing, rehabilitate the soil and be growing food to eat, but I have been letting my dogs run out there, and there's also a feral cat population in the neighborhood. So how do the soil pathogens affect my decisions about how to rehabilitate the soil and make it safe for... Do I need to only be raised bed and container gardening, or what?
What's your concern? Is it the worms
and
the germs from the pets?
Yeah,
from the feces that hasn't gotten picked up enough.
Well, what you need is as much life as you can get to digest that and combat it. Good composting practices. The more organisms you have, the more they will dominate the ecosystem over any pathogens you're concerned about.
Okay, and what about sheet composting for people that do have wild morning glory in their soil?
We're always pulling it. You know, one thing I could say is without doing the cardboard, putting down a mulch layer, but being really on it for pulling the bindweed. The nice thing about it is that it'll go through that, but it'll be a lot looser and easier to pull out than it would go directly in the yard. I gotta say, we need to figure out something about bindweed because it's a really hard one.
It's in my yard too.
To deal with.
And we have another caller. And what was?
I wish I had a better answer.
Okay, and also I live in a really old house, so they used to bury their garbage back there, and I don't know if there's motor oil or anything. So would you just recommend the more organisms to ameliorate that as well?
Don't mess around with the soil too much. You can keep adding more to the top and letting that process happen. So raised beds, sheet mulching, and also planting plants that are those cover crops and cutting them down and letting them be your next mulch layer.
Right. And compost.
I like nitrogen fixers. I like lupins, and I like vetches, and I like clovers for the bottom, but I also like shrubby plants like seaberry and other nitrogen fixing, you know, waist-high plants. So you can keep Excellent. Building and then cut them down in a few years and let them mulch.
Okay, we're going to move on to Ty now. You had a question?
I wanted to get your opinion on this a little bit. I have thinking about this because we're talking locally, and obviously, you know, we want it to be more than just a local practice. We'd like to get people throughout all of our communities here, Portland, the surrounding area, spread it. You know,
right. So, what's your question?
And so, I'm wondering because we have a lot of people growing cannabis. And the research and study I've done on that says it does a lot to repair the soil. I'm wondering what your opinion on the overall impact of the crop diversity in itself. So, like, if people are growing, you know, corn or wheat, if they diversify their crops with stuff like
mixed
like
in with saying, it,
the different lupins, the different, you know, all the different, you know, I mean, cannabis is known to be one of the most ground restorative plants around.
Okay, and Jordan, do you have a comment on that?
Throughout the Midwest, throughout the 40s, for the military and all kinds of stuff, and what they found is the bird populations and the insect populations and everything thrived and increase during those points.
Ty, we're going to let Jordan answer you.
So the way I feel about hemp and other kind of industrial fibers like that is that they ultimately, they can be extremely helpful for ecosystem processes. They've got nice roots. They build good woody material. They store a lot of carbon. But you still need to do agriculture practices in a way that's sustainable. They can be just as damaging as any other plant if improperly grown. So like you were saying, think of it as a full ecosystem and think about what are the needs of that plant and how other plants can support it and how it can support those other plants. So as we start moving into more and more legalization of industrial hemp and other uses of the cannabis plant, we need to be really on it and not just assume that those plants have only a beneficial effect on the ecosystem. I just saw a study looking at erosion increases in California due to cannabis growing, and that may not be the plant's fault. It may be ignorance on the part of the growers. So we need to be having good ag policy for whatever crops we're growing.
And one, we have another caller, but I want to get one quick question in here again to Kristen, which has to do with something called the Quivira Coalition and the Radical Middle. And this is actually getting like farmers who don't even believe that much in global warming, for instance, and environmentalists really working together, the Boots and Birkenstocks organization or something.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is such a hopeful development is that around the, you know, environmentalists and people who were in agriculture used to be really at loggerheads with each other. You know, the environmentalists would say you're ruining the land, and the farmers would say, well, you're denying me an income. Those two groups have really approached each other much more, and there are a lot of environmental groups that have formed partnerships with ranchers and farmers to improve the land that they both love in natural ways. And the Quivira Coalition is one of them. They call themselves the Radical Middle. You know, they're coming together over their love for the land, over their desire to see the land restored. But there are many groups like that around the country. There's a group, that was the group in California, is the California Rangeland Group. And they came together because Defenders of Wildlife was concerned about urban development taking over lands where there were vernal pools and eliminating that ecosystem. And somebody, they were complaining to somebody in the state government, and they said, well, you should talk to the ranchers. They don't like this either. And they, at first, Defenders of Wildlife thought, ranchers, we have nothing in common with ranchers. But then it turned out that there was a Nature Conservancy scientist who found out that cattle grazing, you know, holistic, careful grazing of animals actually improves those habitats, improves those vernal pool habitats. So that was the initial thing that brought those two very different groups of people together. And now they tackle all sorts of issues about, building health on rangelands.
Yeah, if we can just all start working together on this, it's just so huge.
Well,
yeah.
I want to say one thing that we have as a benefit in Oregon, especially in the Portland metropolitan area, is that we have regional government, and we have the ability to actually have control over things like land use and urban design and regional design.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually have a lot of the tools in place that if we just shifted the way we do it. One of the things I work on is called keyline design, which is a method of organizing landscapes to improve soil, but also to make it so that people can live there. And one of the great things about keyline design is it can work for ranches and designing your cattle system, or it can work for actually urban design. And so I think we should be, as we're starting to, you know, every time we expand the urban growth boundary, we need to be actually, rather than letting it just be random, you know, whatever the developers kind of feel is the cheapest thing to do, we need to get those developers excited about the idea of building urban environments that actually facilitate the catching of water, the inoculation of soil, and the preservation of those processes that lead to more and more carbon. We can have cities that enhance and improve carbon sequestration. This right. doesn't have to just be in the middle of a farm in the country.
Absolutely, that's true. I mean, the whole last chapter of my book, I'm talking with people who are doing that, and it's really exciting.
Yeah, and that very last chapter was the first thing I read about. We could actually sequester so much carbon that we reverse global warming. It was amazing. And we did have a last caller. Susanna, you have to do this in 2 seconds.
Okay. I have Oregon Forestry, who are in a comment period, to be thinking about, I use the word carbon capture, it resonates better. So could you make comments to State Forestry about your part of carbon buildup in the soils?
Okay. Are you mean
comments to State Forestry in forestry management practices? Because they might be studying carbon sequestration, carbon capture.
Are you asking us to talk to the Forest
yes.
Service or to talk to you about what we think the Forest Service should do?
No. If you could just comment directly, they're in a comment period right now.
Definitely. I'll take a look at
yeah,
it.
Yeah, me too. And we can all do that. Everybody who's listening can do that. We got to get carbon sequestration into the universe of what we're talking
There's
about.
There's some very easy practices that we could do in our national forests that would increase the amount of carbon sequestration that those forests were doing
right.
easily.
The forests, the urban yeah. areas, the farms, and we could really have a huge impact on our... It's beautiful. So anyway, I wanted to let people know, you have a website, Jordan. What was that?
My website's really basic. My name is Jordan Fink. Uh-huh. My website is jordanfink.com. And it's a website in progress, but it does list the classes that I teach.
Yeah.
And it does, and some of those classes are soil for urban gardeners and farmers. And I also teach, it's going to be this winter, but I'm going to be teaching a permaculture design course. And I speak and interact and
you know a lot.
Well, and I also know a lot of the community here, and there's so much knowledge in Portland. There are many people in the city that have a wealth of knowledge, and we just need to figure out a way of networking and making sure that we move fast, because the great thing about soil carbon over some of these other methods is that some methods of carbon sequestration will take hundreds and hundreds of years. You change policies on a landscape and you can suck so much carbon out of the atmosphere.
In a year. Yeah.
Well, and yeah. combat erosion, and do all these other things. I mean, it's just all good.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all good, except for Monsanto. You know, it's not good for them, but it's good for us.
Right.
And you know, all of us that are in Portland working on questions around carbon sequestration and soil building, we're really grateful that you put this book together.
Thank you.
Totally. And Kristen, what's your website?
It is also simple. It's my name, KristenOlson.com.
And it's OHLSON.
That's true. It's and no E's in Kristen. It's KristinOhlson.
Right. And you're going to be at Powell's tomorrow night. I hope a million people show up for that, 7:30 p.m. And you're going to be at Kailash to do a permaculture mm-hmm. convergence this weekend.
That's right. And I also live at Foster Eco Village, and we have many events that happen around permaculture and ecological design.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming on the show. You've been fantastic. And I think this whole thing has me hopefuler than I've been in eons. So.
Oh, good. Stephanie, you're fantastic. Thank you.
You are great. This has been good.
Okay.
It's just about 12 o'clock here at KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. Stay tuned for the noon news headlines and then Jazz Lives with Nick Gaffro. Thanks for tuning in this morning.
This This is KBOO Headline News for Wednesday, March 26th. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. In local news, it has been 4 days since a massive mudslide destroyed two small rural communities near Seattle. As of today, there are 16 people confirmed dead, with an additional 8 likely dead as well. Authorities are still not certain how many people are missing, with estimates ranging as high as 176. The current high estimate will likely drop considerably. The actual count of the missing may not be known for some time. County officials are compiling a list of the missing using calls received from worried family and friends. The list may include duplicate names.
The periodic bike building event called Manifest will return to Portland this summer for the third year. The competition, previously held in 2010 and 2012, is a quest to design and construct a better bicycle for everyday use. Anyone can participate by submitting their ideas for a better bike design. Unlike in previous years, the winning design this year will be mass-produced for retail sale by Fuji. Online voting for the bike design project begins July 28th and concludes August 2nd. Plans are to have the winning bike available for sale beginning in 2015.
In national news, the White House and the House Intelligence Committee have issued proposals for ending the mass collection of American phone records. Both approaches focus on shifting custody of the phone records back to the phone companies. The committee proposal restricts the mass collection of data by the NSA, but gives increased power to retrieve call data while still in the hands of phone companies. The president's proposal would end the mass collection of phone records by the NSA, but will still allow other types of mass collection of data, such as internet and finance records. Both proposals still need to go through Congress for approval.
Three masked men are accused of parachuting off the One World Trade Center tower in New York, and a fourth is accused of being an accomplice on the ground. The men posted a video on YouTube depicting their exploits. The jump occurred on September 30th, and the men got away without notice. While it is unclear how they were identified, the four turned themselves in after police searched their homes last month. There is some suspicion that the police may not have been planning to prosecute, but were pressured to take action when a young teen also made a well-publicized illegal trek to the top of the building last week.
The Associated Press has reported that a 9-year-old girl was not allowed to make a 911 call from a Texas motel room while seeking help for her mother, who was being stabbed to death. Upon investigation, a national survey discovered that tens of thousands of hotels and motels do not allow guests to make emergency calls. A separate survey by the American Hotel and Lodging Association revealed that less than 50% of all hotels and motels even have direct 911 calling. However, the stabbing of the mother prompted a petition for action that has already gathered over 400,000 signatures, demanding that hotels and motels change this practice.
In international news, a judge in Egypt has ordered mass trials of more than 900 Islamist supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. This follows a mass trial on Monday in which the same judge sentenced more than 520 defendants to death. The defendants are being tried for murder and attempted murder. Judge Sayed Yosef began a mass trial of nearly 700 men on Tuesday, in spite of a boycott by defense lawyers. In total, more than 2,200 defendants are facing mass trials right now in Egypt for a wave of violence that broke out last August. The defendants, who are former members of Morsi's security forces and members of the Muslim Brotherhood, are accused of participating in a crackdown on protesters that resulted in 600 deaths. The U.S. government and the European Union criticized the mass trials, saying that it is inconceivable that so many defendants could receive a fair trial in a single session.
New research from the World Health Organization indicates that air pollution has become the number one health risk worldwide. Indoor and outdoor air pollution kills nearly 7 million people each year. This is nearly double previous estimates. The study estimates that outdoor pollution from traffic fumes and coal burning, as well as indoor burning from wood and coal stoves, kill more people than smoking, road deaths, and diabetes combined.
This is Diane Erickson.
And Patrick Wilson.
With the KBOO News at Noon, produced by volunteers in our Southeast studio in Portland, Oregon. Tune in every night at 5 o'clock for more local, national, and international news. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM in Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM in Philomath and Corvallis, and of course around the world at KBOO.FM. It's time for Jazz Lives, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide. committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com. And let's start the show off today with Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, Ron Carter, Wallace Roney on trumpet, and Tony Williams on the drums.